Okay, I want to start with a little experiment this morning. You need to turn to a neighbor, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds for each partner. So we're going to do a round where one person talks, another person listens, and then another round where one person listens, the other talks. So you turn, find your partner, just kind of non-verbally, like make a signal to the person that's going to be your partner. And then I'm going to give you the question because I don't want you to think about it a lot. Okay? Does anyone need a partner? Okay. So, ladies, in 30 seconds, you need to tell this person who you are. Go. So, I have interviewed for I don't know how many jobs in my life, and the question that always seems like it should be the easiest one, but is always the most difficult one is, tell us a little bit about yourself. And you're like 82 things flashing through your mind, and then you open your mouth and you go, I'm Corey. I'm here for a job interview. Dullest, like most inarticulate thing you can say, but it's this question we are often in our lives trying to work out. Who am I? Who am I? And so I was thinking about this. When do we work this question out in our life? And I was brainstorming and I came up with a couple different times in our life, and this isn't an exhaustive list, but here are some times when we're working out this question or seeking the answer. In adolescence, as we're building friendships, we're trying to figure out how to navigate how to be someone's friend. And so we also have to figure out who we are and what we have to offer someone, right? So who am I? In young adulthood, when students leave the nest, so to speak, and maybe go off to college or go off to start a career, they have this new autonomy and independence for the first time. And that kind of puts this huge question in front of them. Who am I? Now that I'm detached from my family or from my home. Sometimes marriage raises this question. When two I's become a we, and it seems that that we does everything together, or that people just consider you a unit, who am I? Do you maybe lose a little grasp on your identity in marriage sometimes? In new parenthood, I have so many friends who've had babies this year, and I was watching them talk on Facebook, and just some of them talking about how, I don't know who I am anymore. I'm a milk machine, I'm a clothes washer, or if you have older kids, I'm a chauffeur. But who am I? Who am I separate from me being a mother? Maybe at the end of a career, you're ready to retire, and so much of your identity had been built up or shored up by what you were doing or what your role was. Because we spend so much time at work, right? And then when you finish that stage of life and you're on into retirement or on to something else, you ask this question, who am I now? Because that's not defining me anymore. Who am I? And then maybe at the death of a loved one. You know, it could be a spouse. If your spouse dies and you've been together for so long and you were this unit, and you just love that you were together doing these things and now you don't have that anymore. Or, I mean, if my father died, my father is one of the dearest people in my world. If he were to die, I know I would be asking this question. Who am I now that this factor, this person is no longer a part of my life? So those are just some examples. I think we can think of so many more where we might, circumstances or life stage raises this question for us. Who am I? But I think an equally critical question, often it gets asked simultaneously, whether or not we verbalize it or not. And that question is, who is God? When we are searching for the answer to the question, who am I? And if it's in the midst of a really hard season in your life, we are also often asking the question, who is God? We've had a lot of disturbing world events, it seems like, this decade, the last 5 years, the last year, the last couple weeks. Think about the hurricanes and the flooding all over the world, not just in the United States. And things like this, when disturbing world events happen, it can trigger confusion or grief, even if we're not the ones directly affected. When the 2001 September 11th terrorist attacks happened in the United States, I was in my last year in college. I was on a semester in Europe, and I was in London, England that day. And the school was thinking about bringing us all home. There were 50 of us that were going to be traveling throughout Europe. And they were thinking about bringing us home because there was so much uncertainty. But then they decided we actually might be safer in Europe, so they let us stay. But then we were so disconnected from what all the changes that happened in our country. When I came back, I felt like I came back to a different country. So much of the ethos of America had changed, and I had been in an entirely different place. But I remember sitting in my hotel room I don't remember which country it was at this point, but my roommate at the time was named Jen, and we were watching the news, and they just started showing the clips of the people who were jumping out of the buildings. And Jen, I mean, we'd been watching newscasts for weeks and weeks, just trying to stay connected. And when she saw those film clips, Jen just said, "Where is God? How could this happen if God is good?" And those questions really fold under this question, who is God? What is God's nature? Sometimes when we see disturbing things and we can't make sense of them, we start asking about God. But sometimes it's not those world events. Sometimes it's personal things, right? Difficult circumstances or when we experience suffering. And we start to ask, is God good? Does God care about me? I think I see God caring about other people, but does God care about me? Because this is hard. I am suffering. I am lost. I am alone. I am isolated. Does God love me? So who is God to me? When I was a hospital chaplain, I primarily worked the ICUs. And I was in the adult ICU doing my rounds, and I saw that there was a man in our unit who was coming to get his leg amputated. He was a type 1 diabetic and just had a lot of circulation problems over the year, and his leg was gangrenous and they needed to remove it. So I thought, you know, prior to surgery, I would offer a listening ear. And so I went into his room and I just introduced myself and I said I was the chaplain. And he just said, "Chaplain," kind of snorted. So like, "Chaplain, I don't need a chaplain. What has God ever done for me?" And I hadn't said anything except that my name was Corey and I was the chaplain. And he just had all these assumptions about what I would say to him or how I would approach him. But this man came back multiple times throughout the year that I worked in the ICU. And the staff would call him a frequent flyer. Just he had a lot of complications due to his diabetes. And so he would come in usually once a month, sometimes more. And I would just keep going back, not to press anything on him, but just to listen, just to check in. And he just started opening up to me. And it was kind of this litany of woe about how hard his life had been and how he felt so unknown and unseen. And he was not a worshiper of God. He believed there was a God. He'd never followed God. But he blamed God for his misfortune. And I just thought that was so curious, that he believed that there was a God, but because of what had happened to him in his life, he's going to blame God. But he doesn't really know God. And I thought that was so interesting and compelling. And we did a lot of good work together, but he was a crusty man. So just leave him to the Holy Spirit as he would leave our hospital. And so I think here's our challenge. It's natural for people to question God and even blame God when bad things happen. It's even people who don't worship God, but also people who do worship and follow God. These are natural questions that arise when we see or experience suffering. But the Christian way, the way of Jesus, is to resist the temptation to blame God for the misfortunes. And instead, our challenge and our task is to go to God when we experience suffering or desperation and say, "You see what's happening here? Where are you?" Instead of going out and about in the world trying to have the world see, just what's your opinion about what God is doing? Why are we not going directly to God and asking, "Who are you? Who are you to me? Who are you to the world? What are you about? What do you love? What do you value?" That's our task. And so how do we know who God is? Well, in the Christian belief, we ask God questions ourselves through prayer, right? We can go to God directly and pray to God and communicate with God and invite God into our entire days and our weeks and our years to have this ongoing conversation in which we can expect God to return that message and say, I am here, and I do love you, and I am good. Sometimes it takes a little bit of discernment, because God isn't always that megaphone in our ear or just a voice that pierces a darkness, this mysterious, mystical thing. Sometimes we have to have people who love us help us read our lives and read circumstances to say, well, you remember when that happened in the midst of the suffering? Do you think that could have been God providing for you? So instead of just blaming God for the bad things, we need to start looking for the ways God shows up in our lives. We can also go to God and ask God these big questions in his word. We can find the answers in his word. So we go to the Bible, and this is just God's story, right? It's what a blessing to have God's story in front of us that we can pick up every day and read the character of God in his action, in his words, in the testimony about the hope of the future. So we are going to do that together this year. We are going to ask big questions about who God is and about who we are. And then we're going to look for the intersection between the answers. Who am I? I think I'm this. Who is God? God is this. How do these two things connect? So our fall study, as you see on the booklet, is called The Great I Am. Particularly, we're going to the Gospel of John. And we are going to study Jesus' I am statements. John, the way John has written the story of Jesus in his earthly ministry, there are 8 very clear I am statements that Jesus just lays it out there for people. This is who I am. So Jesus got a lot of questions throughout his 33 years as a human being and then his 3 years of earthly ministry. He was asked by both crowds and individuals, by common people and religious leaders and government officials, by strangers and by disciples, who are you? He got that question over and over. And sometimes he would turn it around and ask people the question back. So there were all these rumors and speculation and strongly held beliefs about who Jesus was in the crowds and among his disciples and from the government officials. Some thought he was John the Baptist after John the Baptist was killed. Some thought he was one of the prophets like Elijah or Jeremiah. Some thought he was just a wise teacher. He had a lot of authority, so people wanted to learn from him, but didn't think he was anything more than a wise rabbi or teacher. People knew he was a powerful healer because they were seeing the things that he was doing. And then some actually thought that he was a zealot. And the zealots were people who wanted to overthrow the government. And so they were doing kind of rebellion, military kind of militia rebellions. So some people thought that Jesus, and when he was teaching, they thought they kind of heard shimmers of this zealot philosophy. And they thought maybe he was going to overthrow the Romans. So let's open into week 1 here. It's actually the introduction. The blue page says, who do people say that I am? And you turn to page 2. I'm going to read this Mark 8:27-29 passage. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea and Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? And they told him, John the Baptist, and others said Elijah, and others said one of the prophets. And he asked them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered him, you are the Christ. So it's this question that we are after that Jesus says in 29, but who do you say that I am? That's the question that this fall I want you to try to answer. This is a personal question. Who do you say that I am? So I want you to sit with that all fall. And you can start a list. And it doesn't just have to be the things that you read in Scripture that Jesus says about himself, but how have you known Jesus in your life? Who do you say that I am? How do you testify? What do you know about God? So that's a question we're going to track with. We will hear Jesus make these 8 clear, definitive statements about his identity, and I will read them for you just as a preview. Jesus says, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. He says, this one's a bit more cryptic, and we'll get to it in a couple weeks and explain why he says this, but he says, before Abraham was, I am. End of sentence. Strange. We'll unpack that later. I am the gate for the sheep. It's okay if you don't know anything about being a shepherd or agriculture, we'll fill you in. I am the gate for the sheep. And then he continues on, I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then the last one that we'll see in the Gospel of John is, I am the true vine. So another agricultural reference of a vineyard. So these I am statements are often rooted in the stories of the Old Testament, where God is in relationship with his people Israel, and they're going through various calamities. And you'll see stories in the Old Testament connect with these I am statements from Jesus. And so if you're unfamiliar with the Old Testament, we'll fill you in and we'll help you understand what's the background. You don't have to have read the Old Testament or understand it. We'll fill you in each week. So the I ams go back to a pivotal Old Testament story in Exodus 3. So you can turn back to page 1 in your booklet. And if you are better learning by following along, you can. Otherwise, I'm going to read it out loud for us, and you can just listen, whichever way you prefer. So this is Exodus 3, verses 1 through 15. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush. Moses, Moses, I don't know how God did this. I don't have a good God voice. Moses, I don't know. And he said, here I am. And then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the land of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me. And I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. And then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. And thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. So here we see the beginning of this interplay of, who am I? Moses is feeling insecure. Who am I that you would ask me to do this, or that they would believe me? And so what does God do? God gives Moses his personal name. It says, go to my people and say, the I am has sent me to you, and this is my name forever. God's giving of his personal name, you know, if you think back to the cultures of the day, people gave names to the gods, but there were no gods that gave names to the people. Here, use this name for me. Yahweh was the only one to do that we know of, right? Because all the other gods were empty, just idols. And so here we have God meeting a man, giving him a task, giving him his name, and then sending him on a mission. And I wonder how your story will connect with that. Do you ever feel insecure? Who am I to do this, or to be this, or to live this? And God will come and meet you and say, the I am is sending you. Here's my name. I will be in relationship with you. So Jesus, thousands of years later, is on the scene and starts saying, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. And so if any of the Jewish people were around him hearing this, think of the connections they would have made. Would they have been shocked? Would they have been horrified? Would they have been realizing the thing that they'd been hoping for so long was now in their presence? So we're going to unpack that together this year. One of the reasons that I really like studying the I Ams is that they're so relatable. Even if you don't really have a background in the Bible, you can understand what bread is, and you can understand what light is. And you know the opposite of bread is hunger, and the opposite of light is darkness. And so these metaphors can roll right into your life and have deep meaning for you. And you can wrestle with them, and you can grab onto them and walk them through your week. So I'm really excited about that. But there are also these clear ideas and images, metaphors that we should be able to really dive into. And hopefully they'll give us new life in Christ or refresh our understanding of who Jesus is and enliven our relationship with him. So when I lived in Arizona for 4 years, 2010 to 2014, I spent about half of that time completely unemployed and then about another quarter of that time underemployed, so not making enough money to pay bills, to buy health care, things like that. And that was an incredibly hard time for me. I mean, I had a master's degree and I had years of work experience, and for the life of me could not get a job. I was applying to ministry jobs, but I was also applying to jobs like Home Depot and Baskin Robbins and Target and like anything just to pay the bills while I was looking for a professional job. And no one was calling me for interviews. It was like I was this anonymous person out in the world. So there I was at 30 years old, and I could not support myself. If I didn't have family to live with, I don't know what I would have done, right? And so it was this very my life just got turned upside down, and I was stuck there for 4 years, and I'm like, what in the world? God, you had called me to resign from that job, and I just didn't, I mean, I knew life wasn't supposed to be easy, but I didn't think it was going to be this hard, and I didn't think I would feel so desperate for so long. And I didn't realize that I would be this close to the bottom of my bank account by following you. And it was really hard. I felt really inadequate and desperate, and I felt judged everywhere I went because I lived with my parents at 30 years old. But then at the same time, in those same 4 years, we had this huge family crisis. My brother had been married for 12 years by then, and his wife, just kind of out of the blue, said, I no longer want to be married. I'm leaving. And not only did she leave him, but she left their 4 children. It was totally out of the picture for about 2 years. And she kind of revealed to us like she had been pretty much living a double life for many, many years. And so it was this huge, like, what just happened? What? Like, unbelievable. We would never have thought that all of this was going on. And I, because of all this stuff that was happening in my life, ended up going to a counselor because I just could not process all of this. It was just too heavy. And I got to this place where, because of what happened with my sister-in-law, I had known her since I was 15. I got to this place where I was thinking, what is real? Like, honestly, like, can I trust anyone? Because I had completely trusted her, and she was not at all the person I thought she was. And so it's just like the bottom fell out of my life, and I just felt like nothing was certain. I was wondering, like, is one of my parents going to disclose some kind of wild other life that I didn't know they had? Like, everything was in question. And I just felt like nothing was secure. And so it was a really hard time. And I was asking, what is real? God, can I trust you? Because what do I do with all of this? This is too big. It's too much to handle. Will you be faithful to me? You know, will you help me be able to support myself one day? Like, it just seems like such a simple question and like capable person, but I couldn't make it happen. And I was stuck and I was lost and I was scared. And around this time, I started studying the Gospel of John again, and I started coming upon the I am statements, and they were so simple. And Jesus said, I'm the light of the world. And I was living in darkness of my uncertainty and my fear. And he met me there. And I started to it's just this one simple phrase, just Jesus saying, I'm the light of the world. And it changed my perspective, and it changed the way that I was able to cope. Because it wasn't a quick fix. Life didn't rebuild itself in 2 weeks. I suddenly got a job, and, you know, the stuff with my sister-in-law had never happened. That's just not the way life works. I stayed in that time of uncertainty for a long time, but Jesus met me there with these simple sentences. I am the bread of life. So I started to want to rush to church every Sunday so that I could take communion, and I started hounding my pastor, can we please take communion every week? Because I need it. It's like sustenance. I need to go through this thing where I pick up the bread, I dip it in the wine, and I remember what Jesus did for me, and I remember that he did it for me, and he loves me, and I need to do that every week to remind myself that he's real and he's faithful. Like, I just need to have that physical connection. My pastor was like, well, maybe we'll do it twice a month. But these things, these Jesus revealing his identity is kind of what saved me in that period of my life. That lasted 4 years. So I want you to approach them as a message from Jesus to you. And I want you to be asking this question, who am I? And the question, who is God? And I want you to pay close attention to where the answer to those two questions intersect. So who is Jesus to you? So now I want to give you just a few moments to, on the take notes page, which is on page 3, blank page, just here for you, to write down this question. What questions do I have for Jesus? And it can be anything. What questions do I have for Jesus? And I'm going to give you a couple minutes to start thinking and writing, but you can also take this home with you and spend some time in prayer or thinking, reflecting this week, and fill out a fuller list. What questions do I have for Jesus?